like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance. Today, Thursday, March 31, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Meslow. Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Kamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
All right, Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum. And good morning, Representative Zellers. We're going to take up today, we have a long agenda, but we're going to House File 1406. Representative Zellers, criminal sexual conduct, life without release, sentences provided, maximum sentences increased, sex offender review board established, sentencing guidelines modified, and predatory offender registration and notification requirements modified. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for the time this morning, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Just a minute. Wait till it quiets down.
Forgive me, Mr. Chairman.
We'll wait until people are through fiddling with their equipment.
What do you say, sir?
Yes. All right, I think we're ready. Representative Zellers, we do have a full calendar. We have approximately an hour set aside for this bill, approximately, and you do have four testifiers. So I'm going to give you the ability to walk through your bill the way you see fit, present it, and then let's get to the testimony.
Thank you very much.
The chair will move House File 1406 that it be recommended to pass and that it be laid over for future.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, before we begin, there is an A14 amendment. It's an author's amendment. So I just ask that you grab that first to put the bill in the shape and form that we would like before we get down to the testimony and the line by line.
All right. Let's do that to get the bill in the shape that the author wants. The chair will move the H1406A14 amendment. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. We have 1406 as amended. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I am going to be brief because we do have some testifiers that have come from a reasonable distance and would like to testify. Mr. Chairman, this has been a members of the committee. This has been a two-year journey for not only me but for this bill. A lot of the folks remember what happened last year with the Trisha Dean case, and some folks around the Capitol and maybe even our state have said that this is in some way a reactionary bill. Mr. Chairman, now after 2 years and after going through some of the research, seeing what's happened in some of our communities just in recent weeks just south of us here in Iowa, I don't think that this is reactionary in any way. In fact, I think this is just a realization of what's happened around us in society. I was very close to the community of Grand Forks when I was growing up and going to college. A lot of that was the antithesis for me coming forward with this bill because it was an innocence stolen from my past, from my history. But now going forward, Mr. Chairman, and as we've been through this for now a second year, I really look at this now not only from that aspect, but also from this aspect. And many of the members know I became a new dad, so of course I always have pictures because, thank God, my daughter looks like my wife. But this is what I now introduce this bill for: the future. One of the folks that we may lock up, that we may keep out of our society, that when my daughter's in college, my daughter's in high school, won't have to suffer the loss not only of life, but of innocence that's stolen from them and stolen from many of the victims and sexual predators. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for giving us the time today. I've turned over the line-by-line or just a brief description to Eric Lippman, who is now the director of the sexual, and I always forget your title. I was former Representative Lippman. Representative always in our heart, but former Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator. In trying to keep this very brief, I'm mindful of the other items on the schedule. I want to try to summarize for my friends and colleagues here about what would you want to say when going door knocking in your neighborhood, when you report back about your work, and I hope that this is part of your legacy of fine work this season. And among the things that I think that you'd want to say is that you've responded to the call of the county attorneys to have sentencing as the primary tool for the containment of dangerous sexual predators. And I think this bill does that. in that it places a new and, I think, enhanced role for sentencing in our system as far as a containment of very, very dangerous predators. Secondly, I think you'd want to tell folks in your constituencies if you've used the best science and the best expertise that's available. And I think that this bill corrals and focuses the very best scientific practice, the very best correctional practice, and the needed expertise when in fact, they're needed. So we've modified all of our processes, and we've updated the statutes. And likewise, and I think this is an important point for members to know and for the public to know, is that this bill, I think, goes beyond just addressing particular fact situations, but provides, I think, for the first time, a process for continually reviewing our processes and our methods, and to make sure that we're always at the leading edge, that we're doing all that we possibly can in applying the best correctional practice, the best science, the best expertise. And so we're going to be in a mode of continual review and updating our practice. And so this is not just the response to a particular celebrated case, although that's a part of it, or cases, but it's a way of continually updating Minnesota's practice. And that's why I think this bill is probably different in many respects from all the other efforts on this topic which have preceded it. And clearly, as it's been a two-year odyssey for Representative Zellers since July, it's been day in, day out, every hour of every day for me. And so I'm certainly proud of the work of the many stakeholders that have contributed to this effort, both in the agency level. We're also glad to have three members of the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy here today, some of whom will testify. And let me end with that and go on to just a brief description and overview of the key items of this, I believe, 108-page bill. In Article 1 on sentencing, Representative Zellers and the Governor have proposed a life without release option. You can find that on pages 9 and 11 of the third engrossment. Indeterminate sentencing for certain sexual crimes related to force, both first and second degree, and you can look for details on that on pages 8 through 13. Indeterminate sentencing for repeat sex offenders, folks who have had a prior history, 7 through roughly 13 to 15 on indeterminate sentencing. Doubling the statutory maximums for all criminal sexual conduct crimes so as to give a wider latitude for sentencing judges, and also in the indeterminate element, obviously there are wider ranges as well. And that can be found on pages 8 through 15. A new criminal sexual predatory conduct crime, again, based on the pattern sex offense, but it's a new crime. If you look on pages 7 and 8 and also on 15, for those crimes which are related to a sexual purpose or sexual goal or sexual victimization, but for whatever reason, thankfully, that doesn't come to pass, we still think that that's dangerous conduct. So the burglary where the rape is intended, the kidnapping where the rape is not consummated, we still think is dangerous predatory behavior, and so we want to have an enhanced penalty there. In Article 2, beginning on page 16, there's a shall authorization for a sex offender review board. I know that there was a great deal of discussion on a parole board type concept yesterday. Here what we're suggesting is that a broad authorization be given for indeterminate sentencing, and that the Commissioner of Corrections report back detailed recommendations for the duties, composition, and procedures of any review board, any parole board type function, for that debate to happen later. That parole board wouldn't need to begin work until year 9, and so I think that there's plenty of room between now and year 9 for the legislature to define the parameters of that board. But we think that any indeterminate sentencing plan necessarily obliges some sort of authority to release prisoners. In Article 4, beginning I guess I would direct members' attention to pages 38 and 39, modifying the felony escape statute so as to include folks who escape while on past eligible status for a provisional discharge. There already is a statute on point to deal with the escape that happened in St. Peter on Good Friday, but if those folks had been outside of the facility on provisional discharge or past eligible status and had decided to abscond to Nebraska, we would have had difficulty under our current law in facilitating their return. On pages 40 and 41, there is an enhanced penalty for indecent exposure to an unaccompanied minor. This is based directly upon a recommendation from the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy. The commission was of a view that when someone exposes to an unaccompanied minor, that presents a special risk because one is sexualizing children as opposed to the creepy behavior of just exposing oneself to the world where it's both minors and adults. That's a very different crime, that if you're singling out unaccompanied minors, that it's more than just exposure, and so that should be punished more strenuously. And Article 8 is the point that I made earlier about the process of continually reviewing our practices. Article 8 would authorize the governor to appoint five professionals who are well experienced in treatment, law enforcement, assessment, and sex offender management to continually review our practices, to set certification or recommendations for certification and things like caseload standards, and to continually work on applying what is the best known science from other states and nationally and internationally here in Minnesota. One of the happy results of the now five reviews that have happened of the sex offender management practices we have here in Minnesota is that we have learned from folks internationally and nationally that they frequently point to Minnesota as among the very best on our practices. Can we get better? Clearly, there's room for improvement. We want to be the best. But I think that we need a formal process to continually assess what we're doing and to make sure that we're always applying the very best practice. With that, be pleased to turn back over the microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in going through the both this year's bill and last year's bill, Representative Meslow was not only a confidant but also a co-presenter in many of these cases, so I wanted to make sure and thank him. And we have another alumni in the room who will be testifying very shortly. That's Representative now Chief Strand will be coming up here. And I thank both of them for a lot of the help on this and formulation. And Representative Lesh, who is not here yet, and actually I don't think he's on the committee this year anymore. So although he's not here, he was also one of our chief co-authors and crafters last year. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to now turn over for testimony. I have here with me Amy Blom, who would like to give a brief testimony for the committee members.
Ms. Blom, welcome, and we are being recorded as a record, so give us your name and then please proceed.
My name is Amy Blom. I was married to Donald Blom. I believe the most violent sex offenders should receive life sentences. I met Don in 1992. After years of physical abuse, I believed it was my fault. He had so much control over me, my mind was paralyzed to reach out for help. I don't believe that violent sex offenders can change. They could just get better at controlling and picking their victims. Time after time, we see violent sex offenders released and killed. It haunts me to this day how many more victims of Don's are out there that will never be able to speak for themselves. We have come a long way since I met Don in 1992. At the time, an already five-time convicted sex offender with numerous aliases. He was not on probation, no sex offender notification at the time. We have passed laws since then to track violent sex offenders and supervise them. Not until 1999, when he killed Katie Poyer after already been convicted of five previous sex offenses, did he finally receive a life sentence. I did not feel safe until 6 months after he was sentenced to life in prison. He tormented and tortured me, and the emotional pain I feel is a life sentence. They choose vulnerable victims. Once they are finally caught, the victim should be able to feel safe. I know it took me so long to be able to speak. I know there are so many that never do. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions from the committee of Ms. Blum? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call Chief Strand, our former representative Strand, would like to testify as well.
Sure. Welcome, Chief.
Morning.
Give us your name for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Steve Strand. I'm the police chief in Lakeville and was also privileged to be a member of the governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy this past fall and winter. And I'll be brief. I'll simply buttress what Representative Director Lippman had to say in terms of sort of the global perspective on this bill and on this issue. There's one thing that I've come to recognize since becoming involved in this issue as a legislator a couple of years ago, and it is that the issue of sex offenders is inherently complex. It is incredibly complex. It does not lend itself to sound bites. It doesn't lend itself to easy solutions. And that's one of the things I was always impressed with as a member of this committee, and I continue to be impressed with it, is that I think that you look at things in a very balanced way. You look at it in terms of public policy. And Chair, Director Lippman referred to this, but we need to get away from the idea that we'll sort of veer back and forth in terms of policy as it relates to politics. A recurring theme of the issue of sex offenders is that this is a moving target. We need to focus on best practices. That includes not just sentencing. Everyone will focus on the sentencing part of this bill, but it also includes things like supervision procedures. What's our best practice for supervision? Training. How do we train people who supervise sex offenders? How do we deal with a broad spectrum of offenders? Because there is a very broad spectrum of offenders. Again, we talk a lot about the worst of the worst, but there is a sort of a bell curve in terms of offenders, and how do we treat all of those people? And then finally, we're sort of moving the burden of responsibility and focus away from maybe treatment and focusing on the offender and focusing more on public safety and protecting the public. That's the bottom line of this bill. Probably the most important part of the bill, in my opinion, is the indeterminate sentencing aspect of this bill, which includes a very important change in law, which is the review board, which is really a form of parole, which was abolished, of course, many years ago in Minnesota. And that parole board has a key function in terms of placing the onus on the offender to prove why they should be released into the public. And I think that's what your constituents, the public, are expecting. And again, as somebody who's been involved in this issue for a while, I think we all need to stop using, and when I say we, I mean this whole state, all of us involved, need to stop using the issue of sex offenders as a political football, and rather to focus on long-term good public policy that is comprehensive and that is balanced and that is not reactionary. Representative Zeller's talked about the perception sometimes that these things are a reaction to certain cases. The inclusion that Representative Zeller's has, which was a recommendation of the commission, was to include a policy board that focuses in an ongoing way on sex offenders rather than simply hitting on it every so often if something happens, if something very public and very tragic happens. And that will start us to creating a comprehensive and balanced approach. And I think this bill starts us in that direction. As a member of the commission, I can tell you that this was a diverse group of people who looked at this from several different perspectives and in a very comprehensive and balanced way. I think this is a very solid bill, and I'm just here to express my full sort of support for the process, for the bill, and I hope that we'll have a good outcome this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Chief Strand? Chief? Steve, thanks for coming. Thanks for your work. All right. Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and also an additional thank you to Chief Strand, because he actually started the indeterminate sentencing in early 2003, even probably 2002 after being elected. So this is a long time coming for not only for our committee or for this bill, but also for him as well. He started working on this a great deal before this, so I really appreciate his knowledge on this and the amount of commitment that he put into this. That's all we have for testifiers, Mr. Chairman. We stand for questions or comments.
Very good. We've got a number of hands that have gone up. Let's see the hands again. I've got only three names down. We've got Representative Cornish, then Murphy, then Newman, then Paymer. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, a couple of comments and then a question. In my experience, starting back in 1976, was my first apprehension of a sex offender, and then again in the 1980s as a deputy of another sex offender, and then most recently I carry a large scar on my arm from apprehending a sex offender. It's still fresh in my mind, and it seems to me that it's the the crime that I had the most problem with reoffense, and I can't think back of the number of sex offenders I've either arrested or had contact with that hadn't offended before or gotten out after my conduct and found out that they've offended again. Or when I go back to the Blue Earth County Jail to see the people that I had contacted. In your study, a couple of questions. In your research of this, how prevalent is that, the recommitting of the offense? And naturally, I'm more of the lock them up for life type. I think people know that. And the second question is, have you ever considered, or the governor considered in his proposal to you and your bill, manual, mechanical, or chemical castration? And if you haven't gotten your bill, why not?
Mr. Chairman, and I'll also defer to Commissioner Lippman, or Director Lippman. Representative Cornish, the study that I've done in the last couple of years, and surprisingly Texas has quite a bit of the recidivism studies that they've looked at, and in a lot of these cases, for the one victim that we catch them, quote-unquote catch them at, there may be as many as 15, 20, even upwards of 30 other victims. What we find is that they get better at this. I mean, they're predators. They hone their skills. They prey on the most vulnerable, and they use threats. They use threats of violence against their victims, that if they do come forward, if they do testify, I will come back, I will revisit the crimes I committed on you tenfold, a hundredfold, whatever it may be. So the recidivism rate, well, albeit maybe low in some studies that you'll see, I know there was one out in, I think, November of 03 from the Department of Justice that showed a very low rate, it's because we don't catch them all the time at the actual crime that they've committed. And as far as to your second question, I believe Representative Emmer has a bill for the chemical castration and voluntary physical castration. I know in other states, some that would be perceived as a little bit more moderate or progressive than ours, say California, they have that provision. I don't know if Representative Emmer, where his bill is, but if it comes to the floor, I can guarantee I'll be supporting it. But as far as the governor's proposal, I'll defer to Representative Lippman on some of the suggestions that they may have.
Representative Cornish? I'm sorry, Mr. Lippman, did you want to also respond?
Yeah, just very briefly, Mr. Chairman. I think just a couple of points. One is that the studies that have been done in Norm on Minnesota's population that we've done suggest that the effective combination is both treatment, aggressive treatment, and aggressive supervision, and that it's really two sides of the same or two component parts of the same strategy, which is aggressive treatment and supervision, and that has lowered our rates than what we would have ordinarily predicted, that dangerous offenders levels 1, 2, and 3 might have offended at a rate at, and so that when you treat and aggressively supervise, we can depress that rate lower. The bad news in that equation is that we can only guess that that a offender will perform or reoffend at a rate in an aggregate amongst a particular population. We're not clairvoyant, and so you can make statistical actuarial guesses about based upon this offender's profile at what rate is he likely in a larger group to offend, but you can't make any confident predictions about that particular offender. And so key pieces I think of the strategy are long sentences. That's what the county attorney suggests. That's the governor, certainly his best judgment, and Representative Zeller's. And then for those folks who are returned to the community, make sure that we have aggressive resources for supervision, because the best check against reoffense is an active, highly trained, aggressive agent, you know, with a low caseload.
Mr. Chairman, members, I guess that's it made my point. The thing that impressed me most, I've been lobbying the rest of the committee members here and sending them email about cases, and I was going to start out looking for cases that had reoffenders, but it turned out I didn't have to look. Every national or local case I found, when I cut, copy, and paste the email to the rest of the members, every case that I found or have since then, it's been a reoffense case. I was going to try to make my case, and the papers did it for me without searching. I haven't found a case yet, it seems like, where it's a serious sexual offense where it isn't a recommitter. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for former Representative Littman. Mm-hmm. Mr. Littman, I'm kind of torn in my mouth to ask you questions about this bill, and I'm trying to support the goals, and I know you're going to change as you go along, but I'm especially concerned about the fiscal note that we have received, 30-page fiscal note. I wonder if you could address that and pay particular attention to the long-term fiscal considerations on page 5. But I'm concerned about almost something on every page. But if you could give us a brief introduction of it and how you think that this goes along with the task force's deliberations along the way. And certainly they had to have talked somewhat about the cost and the potential cost of this to the state and what it means to every single state budget that will have before us forever.
Yes,
Mr. Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. I think there are a couple of answers. The first is that in the governor's budget, the impacts presented by this bill are accounted for. And so it's true that the plan here is paid for in the short term and will require and does have significant long-term impacts going forward in the future. I think from my perspective, there is an emerging consensus that both by party and also by all the stakeholders that have looked at it, that a broader range of indeterminate sentencing needs to happen. You know, I think if you ask the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, if you ask the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy, Senator Random, Senator Neville, Senator Kleist, the governor, everyone agrees that a broader range of indeterminate sentencing is the way to go. An incredibly broad group of stakeholders have come to that conclusion. I think the debate is how wide a range to be, and indeed Senator Neville and Senator Random in their contrary proposal suggest that they have a different place to draw that line. That's clearly the province of the legislature as to where to set the line, but I think at least the more significant part of the debate, I think, has already been resolved, which is their broad agreement, broad consensus, that we do need indeterminate sentencing, and what level of public safety can we afford. As to that question, the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy, I think, was most eloquent, if I could have just four sentences of a dramatic reading from page 39 of the commissioner's report. Lastly, it's clear that public safety programs in Minnesota are important priorities. It's true in times of budget surplus and in budget shortfalls. It's true in Republican, Democratic, and independent administrations. It's true regardless of which political parties control the houses of the state legislature. In Minnesota, good ideas for improving public safety always get a fair hearing. And I think that that's true today, which is this a costly and expensive enterprise? Yes, but I think the Governor's Commission's review of history is that whatever is necessary to assure public safety, we'll make room for and the priorities for.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, you brought up the Senate proposal, and what was the Senate proposal that would compare with state
policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I think one caveat and then the answer. The one caveat is, as a former member and now as perhaps a supporter of House File 1406 and Senate File 1325, I've always been dubious of fiscal note inflation. I think every advocate on the committee has been in that place before. I would sound a cautionary note that if folks of good faith could accurately predict the impact 50 years out, that they would probably be playing the NASDAQ or picking the Powerball numbers. So I would put in the caveat that there's a great risk of predicting what technology and cost impacts are going to be 50 years out. But with that said, I think the fiscal impact of 1875 at around the same 50-year point is closer to 1,200 beds than it is the worst-case scenario, somewhere between 3,500 and 7,500 beds. which is the one reflected on the fiscal note that you have. It's still a major resource commitment, regardless of where one draws the line. But again, I think that there is considerable dangers in relying too heavily on a projection 50 years out. And indeed, look at the breadth of the uncertainty, which is somewhere between 3,500 beds and 7,500 beds is quite a margin of error. And again, I think it's because the key element is it's hard to predict in advance what a parole board might do as far as release decision making, and the fiscal note sets out various scenarios, minimum plus 2, minimum plus 10, minimum plus 20, never, and indeed the most egregious impact is a pricing of no one ever gets out ever, the most draconian parole board one could imagine, but all of those are priced so as to give a range of possible indicators for the legislature. I guess returning to my central point is I would approach with caution some of the more dour and could be hysterical claims over 50 years of what the cost will be. I think the better judgment is the one of the Governor's Commission, which is we're always interested in the best public safety practice and we'll hire and pay for the best professionals to do it.
Mr. Chairman, just one... Just one comment for Representative Murphy and the committee members as well, and I apologize. I'm going to run out for a quick second and come right back. But one of the things that we went through this with last year is we asked the Department of Human Services to do a little bit of background for us as well on what the cost savings would be to their department when it comes to civil commitment, taking some of the folks who are under civil commitment out of our state hospitals at roughly $320 a day and putting them in our state prisons at $70 or roughly $70 a day. And going out, granted it's 2012 and we start to see savings, and this is last year's numbers, but I think we can extrapolate a rough estimate. It's $2 million, but by year 2020, we're saving on a consistent basis $20 million a year when it comes to our Department of Human Services budget. So, and besides the fact of the court costs for trying a Rodriguez, a Blum, or whatever case, time and again, when you're looking at maybe roughly $1 million, $1.5 million for each individual case, the court system, and I'm sure that it's in here somewhere where they'll account for those savings, but it's not a line item that says savings for courts or savings for DHS. But I think it's definitely something you have to take into consideration, because not only the constitutional aspect of it, but the cost savings of a state hospital versus their state prison. And I can make that available. Again, it's rough numbers from last year, but I can make it available for committee members as well.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that information. And then, Mr. Edmund, as you reviewed the fiscal note of the patient center, was there anything in here that you were very surprised about or that you totally disagreed with or almost totally disagreed with?
Mr. Lippman.
Yes.
Again, the major caveat, and I think it's the highest dollar number, which is, again, I would approach with healthy skepticism a prediction over 50 years, particularly with a range of 50% on either way. So that I think augurs some caution. I guess the other interesting points of the, and I just read the preliminary one. I'm sure the same information is also in the final one, which came out this morning. Is the suggestion of the resources for the parole board? Again, as I suggested, they won't begin work till year 9. So I think crediting against, and again, it's a fairly small dollar amount, crediting against current biennium or the next biennium sums for the review board, which won't review and until there's somebody to review many years hence, I think is maybe inadvertent, but a little cheeky. I mean, we won't be convening them for some time yet, so I think that to begin present charging is a little bit unfair. The other interesting item that I think bears members note is the suggestion from the Attorney General's office that each review of the civil commitment referrals, House File 1406 would add a lawyer to the review process about whether an offender who is an inmate in prison should be referred for possible civil commitment at the end of their determinate sentence. And they suggested, again on the preliminary one, it's page 10, I can try to find the right site in the approved one, but that it would take 17 hours for an assistant attorney general to review these records for civil commitment. I don't raise it as far as pricing, but I think it's an important point to make, which is if a decision requires a lawyer to spend 17 hours to make, these are difficult, complicated, involved decisions to make. And so, more than just the equivalent with the pricing, I don't know whether it's 17 or 16 or whatever hours on average. The point that I think is worthy for members to realize is that when reviewing the files and detailed files of dangerous offenders and as to whether they should be referred to civil commitment, these are really very difficult decisions. Indeed, our best lawyers suggest that each decision might oblige 17 hours worth of work. And so that suggests the seriousness and the importance and the complexity of those difficult decisions. They're not, as I think has been unfairly suggested many times, fairly snap decisions where you can kind of pick up a file and say, well, of course that guy needs to be referred. On average, it's a 17-hour decision. Forget that.
Very good. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Littman. This is a bill, it's over 100 pages. I haven't yet read it, although I will assure you that before it hits the floor, I will have read it and hopefully understand it. But I remember former Justice Scargring in this committee testifying about certain kinds of crimes for which she was recommending the possibility of parole. My recollection, for instance, had to do with torturing a victim. When I look at the first three or four lines, it talks in the bill requiring life without release sentences for certain egregious first degree criminal sexual conduct offenses. And then we go to, for instance, in Article 2, you've got in here ineffective parole board. Satisfying my rather draconian philosophy in this area, can you give me assurances that there are certain types of egregious offenses, first-time offenders, who are going to be locked up and they will not be allowed to go in front of the review board established by Article 2?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, if I could direct your attention to page 9 of the bill. On the third of Grossman, line 1 continues another section, but it's got the key word, life without the possibility of release. And if you look at line 5, it says, the offender tortured the complainant.
Thank you, Mr. Lippman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Congratulations on a 15-second answer.
Mr. Chairman.
Let's see if we can do that again. Representative Klemar.
Mr. Chair, I have a question of the author. Is he gone now or what?
Representative Klemar, he is in another room on another bill. He'll be back as soon as he can. If you can ask the question of Lippman, please do so or hold it until he comes back. He'll be back shortly.
If there's other people who want to ask questions, I'll wait.
We'll come back. Please remind me when he's back. Representative Eastland, then Mesla. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lippman. I'm just kind of curious that for a number perspective, how many criminal sexual conduct convictions are there of any kind, like in our state on a given year?
Mr. Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, I guess the short answer, I'll probably have to get back to you. I know that Barb Pimms of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is here. She probably would have the ready fact. It's my understanding that there are roughly 1,400 inmates in the correctional system for a governing offense of a criminal sexual conduct crimes, and that there are another 1,000 or so who are currently incarceration that have a history of criminal sexual conduct. So, again, I think if you roughly 30% of our prison population is folks who either are serving a CSC crime offense or have a history of criminal sexual conduct. out in the probation population, those folks for whom have never gotten to prison, there are probably another several thousand, but I'd have to get back to you. It's a large number.
Ms. Toombs of Sentencing Guidelines here. She may be able to add an answer to that. take a seat and identify yourself and please proceed.
I'm Barb Jones, Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We had 607 crim sex sentences last year.
607. Mm-hmm. And then of that 607, how many of those would fall into this this category of criminal sexual conduct 1, 2, where we would be dealing with these higher level or 20 years to life and the probation and that sort of thing?
Ms. Stone.
Chairman Smith and Representative Eastman. I was really doing good with the 607. Let me think if I can find a breakdown of that.
On yours. Page 20? Is that
Representative Chairman Smith and Representative Eastman, are you looking for the life without parole or life with possibility of parole?
I think both.
Okay. The life with no release. There was 12 first-degree offenders who we felt would qualify because they currently are receiving a departure, which is twice the presumptive sentence. That would be an indication to us because of the aggravated departure that they had characteristics and such, and we looked at the departure reasons, and they were things like in a zone of privacy, unusual cruelness, those types of things that would qualify for that a never-be-released category.
Okay. And then how about that would be 20 years to life with the possibility of parole?
Ms. Toombs.
Chairman Smith, Representative Eastman, we identified approximately 196 offenders who would fall into that category.
What was the number?
196. They met the criteria.
Thanks.
Very good. We have Representative Maslow next, but before we do that, we'll take just a 5-second break and welcome to a tour group that's with us today with the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Site Group. We have students from the Meadow Creek Christian School from Anoka, Minnesota. Welcome to our committee. Very good. Representative Messel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I have is really more in the way of comment than it is question, but I want to step back and really express my appreciation for the tremendous work that's been done here, and in particular, Director Lippman, as well as Representative Zellers. I know that you two have immersed yourselves in this issue, and the body of work that we have in front of us is the result of the time and the effort that you've put into it, and it has been time and effort well spent, and I want to thank you for that because this is a very important thing for the people of Minnesota. It is an expensive plan, and it should be. As I sat here this morning listening to the testimony of Ms. Blum, the word that came to my mind was just chilling. And as I heard her speak, that word predator just has been echoing in my head ever since then. And that's what we're talking about, is we're talking about predators and how we are going to address them and deal with them. This is money well spent to protect the people of Minnesota. And as I look at the proposal, there are two provisions that I am particularly pleased to see. One of them is the aggressive improved monitoring of sex offenders who have been released from prison. I think that too often the challenged and stretched resources that we have through our probation people have limited their ability to closely monitor these dangerous predators, and I'm pleased that we can deal with that. The second piece for me that is so important is the indeterminate sentencing. It's interesting to hear this in light of yesterday's testimony on the parole board, because I actually think about this as parole board in reverse. When we heard the parole board testimony, it was really saying we've got some long sentences for some people. should we be letting some of them out sooner? And here I look at the Sex Offender Review Board, and it's basically saying, hey, let's make sure we're not letting people out until we think it's safe to have them out there. And I think that's really important. I would love to have had that opportunity at the time that Alfonso Rodriguez was released. But even more than that, if we look around and see the way the civil commitment process has increasingly been used in sex offenders, I don't think that's the optimal way. Because I don't believe that most sex offenders are sick in the head. I think they are sick in the heart. And that means that we need to be addressing that in the criminal process, not the civil commitment process. This is the proper option and the way that we should be doing it. Those people should not be out among our citizens unless and until there's a panel that believe it's safe to allow that to happen. This bill, this proposal, addresses those concerns, and I am wholeheartedly behind it and very appreciative of your work.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sellers, Mr. Lippman, I also applaud the work that you've done. I think you know how concerned you are, as we all are in the legislature, about fixing a problem. And that is the question of is how we fix the problem, I think. And I think Representative Murphy hit on an important point here about the cost of fixing it one way or another, and I know the Senate's grappling with that too. There's parts of your bill that I like, the supervision, the training, the monitoring, and even the indeterminate sentencing. I have a question, Representative Zellers. Would you agree with me that, sort of following up on Representative Meslow's comments about whether they're sick in the head or sick in the heart, that there would be basically two categories of sex offenders, and one would have a psychopathic personality, and one would be, as Representative Meslow was saying, sick in the heart, would be more of a sociopathic personality. Would you agree that those two would be accurate descriptions of sex offenders, and for that matter, many criminals?
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Smith, Representative Paymar, my apologies for running in and out. There's a tiny little hospital proposal in my district that is... It's also up at the same time, so my apologies. In talking with Representative Emmer about his castration bill, when dealing with pedophiles, that is, I would say, is maybe sick in the heart or the urge, where the chemical castration wouldn't necessarily work with maybe a rapist or someone along those lines. So I would agree that there are differentiations, and I would say that there, yes, are a couple of different versions, but I would say that at any given time, any of these individuals can move from one group or classification to the next. And a lot of the stuff that I've read, articles, including studies, including newspapers, including you name it, there are folks that start off at a very low level exposure. Maybe it's a groping, maybe it's a peeping Tom, something like that. But as they become not necessarily more comfortable, but more educated or more advanced in what they're doing, they graduate up to the next level. Then they're, you know, it's a violence, it's rape, it's murder, it's along those lines. But
maybe
I think there are two. I think there are more than just two categories. I think there are several different. And if you had asked me 2 years ago, would I say that? I'd probably put them all into one category. So I think there are varying degrees. And as far as, you know, you mentioned the Senate proposal, and there's been quite a bit of talk about that. And I guess the short answer to that would be, I think our bill is safe, their bill is sorry, and when it comes to dealing with these violent predators, I'd rather be safe than sorry.
Mr.
Representative.
Maybe I'll try to be a little clearer here about what I was trying to get at. If you look at the laws here in the state of Minnesota, the sexual psychopathic personality, three of the criteria are engaged in a habitual course of misconduct in sexual matters, has an utter lack of power to control the person's sexual impulses, and as a result of this inability to control his or her behavior, is dangerous to other persons. So, you know, what we've thought is those are the people that should be locked up either civilly or criminally for indeterminate time, right? Because those are the most dangerous. And I would ask then, it would seem to me that this population also would not be deterred by the thought of going to prison for life because of their psychopathology. So if that is the case, then you have another category of people that are sociopaths, and those are the people that, you know right from wrong and don't care and are going to commit a heinous crime, and we know about that kind of criminal behavior. The question I'm trying to get at, and I want an answer from you, is whether you think that the sociopathic rapists who know the difference between right and wrong, do you think that there is an unintended consequence of having life without parole as a sentence?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pavar, are you saying, so basically you're saying if they know and have no disregard, that then they'll just kill their victim. Is that the end all that you're getting to in the question?
That's exactly the question I'm asking, because I asked that Ms. Aller is gone now, and she did some wonderful work for me, and I want to share it with the committee at some point, and you, Representative Zellers.
But both German families.
I asked her those questions, and what she did is she provided some very interesting research on the three strikes and you're out law that several states have enacted, and that's the only thing I can really compare what you're doing with,
sure.
Because you're saying life without parole, and it's not just Representative Newman for someone who tortures someone. There's 8 other elements here that could get you life without parole. And some of the offenders should be in prison for life. But I just want to read this real quickly, Mr. Chair. It says that, this is in 2001, it is likely that the laws, the three strikes, increases homicides because a few criminals, fearing the enhanced penalties, murder victims and witnesses to limit resistance and identification. The basic finding in this research was that three strike laws are associated with a 10 to 12% increase in homicides short term and a 23 to 29% long term increase. And so research after research seems to point that out, that if you knew that you were going to go to prison for the rest of your life for your third strike, and I would add an extension in this bill, if you knew and you had kidnapped someone or committed a heinous rape and you knew you were going to go to prison for the rest of your life, you knew the difference between right and wrong, and you would you not, is there not an unintended consequences that you would kill your victim?
Sure.
Representative Zellers.
Chairman Smith, Representative Paymar. And we've addressed, over the last couple of years, we've addressed this a number of ways, a number of times. I've spoken with mental health professionals as well, that it's awfully hard for us as laymen or amateur psychologists to get into the mind of those people. Statistics don't necessarily prove out that, yes, if they know in the back of their minds, I'll go to jail forever if I rape this young woman, will they kill their victim? Personally, no, I don't think that there would be that unintended consequence. And secondly, again, as we started off the discussion, this is not necessarily about the treatment of the pedophile, the predator. This is about protecting society. And if we, in indeterminate sentencing or in a for life sentence, prevent a future victim, whether it's a rape or a brutal beating or mental torture, in some cases the mental torture is way more harmful and detrimental to the victim than the physical torture. So I guess it's a hard game to play with numbers when we're talking about the psychopath or the mentality or the thought processes of people who are of that persuasion. I think it's a hard numbers game to play with the mind and what motivates, especially people who, you and I as rational thinking people, we don't have these thoughts, we don't have these conclusions come to our minds. We have to get inside the minds or ask those folks, and again, they're a predator at their base. They're not going to give us their honest answer. I just think it's a hard numbers game to play with the psychology of a predator. And in that case, I would rather err on the side of safety and keeping these folks in jail longer than letting them out.
Mr. Chair.
And I apologize, I know Dr. Libman has been asked some questions, or he's had some answers. He's been asked.
I'm sorry.
Like offers.
Just very briefly, I know that we're.
Excuse me, Representative or Mr. Libman. These your questions are valid. They are also in the area of discussion or argument. What I'd like to do is get this question answered, shift gears, go to the amendments, then we'll go back to the discourse stage, and then we'll go from there. on this point then, Mr. Litter?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. For the hypothetical of a dangerous psychopathic sociopathic personality, a criminal who has the ability to control their impulses but chooses not to because they enjoy this behavior, under the current law, they get to the end of their term of sentencing, what I call the model prisoner, awful human being. Okay? Can't wait to get out to reoffend. Have no intention of curbing. I could, but I have no intention of curbing my awful desires. What the current law says is we let them out. If we can't prove, can't meet the high burden for civil commitment, we have a meeting at the high school. So we'll notify this person is out there. And I think for many people in the legislature, in the governor's office and in Representative Zeller, those are inadequate responses to somebody who could control their behavior and therefore is not appropriate for civil commitment but chooses not to, and we don't have any good controls over those persons other than perhaps the dedicated supervision agents. And so necessarily this is a set of line drawing about where sentencing policy should be. And I think the intent of House File 1406 is to say there's a group of offenders for whom until we can be more confident than we are today that they're safe for return should be treated in prison.
That wasn't my question.
Well, no, but I think that's what the current law does. With respect to does it inspire further and more heinous crimes, my understanding of the research points the opposite direction. I'd be grateful for the things that Judy Zoller has found. It's my understanding that there is not folks who, with a handy copy of the sentencing guidelines, go and say, well, I will do this, but I won't do that because of the penalties. I don't think, from what I understand about the current research in the criminal mind, that's plausible. But I'd be eager to see what you have.
At this time, we are going to go to the amendments, discuss those, and then get back into discussion stage. I have four amendments, I believe, at least, and Representative, what we'll do here is Representative Hillstrom, I think they're all yours. I'd like you to take them one at a time, present it, then I'll ask Representative Zellers if he accepts the amendment. I want a yes or a no, and then you can discuss it at that point if you wish. That may help the rest of us, and then we'll go from there. Representative Hillstrom, which one first?
I'd like to start with the A-15 amendment.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-15 amendment deals with page 6, conditional release of sex offenders. Currently in the bill, it doesn't make change to current law. A conditional release of a sex offender who's convicted of these crimes is on conditional release for 5 years. This amendment changes it to 10 years. And also the second piece of it says that if they have a previous sex conviction, that then they are on conditional release for the remainder of their life.
Representative Zellers is the author. First, do you agree and accept that amendment, or do you not? Then tell us why.
May we ask one question of the author of the amendment first, Mr. Chairman, because it could lead to a yes answer.
Ask your question.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, looking at the A-15 amendment, I think my only question is I'm not sure exactly, having had time to study it, how it fits into the life without, I'm sorry, the life with possibility of release sentences. And I think the assumption would be that there would be long periods of supervision probably for the remainder of their life. I guess just as a technical matter, there isn't objection to very long series of supervision. I'm just not sure how this fits in, you know, just on the fly with the other items. I think clearly the idea of going from 5 to 10, you know, is a fine and non-hostile provision. I guess I'm not sure exactly on the fly how lines 4 through 6 mesh with the other parts of the bill. Perhaps council might be able to help of how that would work. It's a question. I'm not sure of the impact on the fly.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Littman, this was a bill I introduced 2 years ago.
Correct.
It had a hearing in the past, so it isn't on the fly. It is currently a bill that has been in for some time. Basically, the gist of it is in the event you're going to let them out, if they currently would get 5 years of supervision, now they're going to get 10. If they have a previous offense, now they're going to be supervised for life.
Lifetime supervision, 5 to 10.
That's right.
Do you understand, and what's the answer, Representative Zellers?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Very good. Any discussion on this amendment? Any questions or discussion on the A-15 amendment? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Hilstrom, next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take the A-16 amendment.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is also a bill, we also had a hearing in the last round, appropriates $500,000 for the purpose of tracking bracelets. And it basically states that the commissioner shall use the bracelet to monitor high-risk sex offenders who are on supervised release or probation to help ensure that the offenders do not violate the conditions of their release of probation.
Okay, at this point, Mr. Carter, this amendment deals with bracelets and $500,000. How does this fit in with the budget?
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that the governor also has recommended in his budget that there be money put into the Department of Corrections for bracelets.
So it looks like it fits. Representative Zellers, do you accept this as the author or do you not?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any discussion or questions on the A-16 amendment? Any discussion? If not, those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next amendment, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A-18 amendment.
Go ahead.
Okay. What this amendment does is it also authorizes that polygraphs can be used as a condition for release for level 3 offenders, and there's also a provision that we can make them pay for it. What we find with offenders is many often there are many more victims than we ever knew about. And while you can't use polygraph in a court of law to convict somebody of a crime, it certainly does give us a tool for the people that are going to be out to find out what was their MO. What is their victim like? So as part of their condition of release, helps you understand who their victims were, how to keep them away from them, and to make sure that they are not violating their conditions of release.
Representative Zellers.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Any discussion on the amendment? Questions? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, my question is this. Let's just say somebody, a sex offender, level 3 sex offender, takes the polygraph, fails the polygraph, then we're going to go to a revocation hearing of some kind. Is that going to be admissible? And what legal authority is there to use that, Dr.?
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is a very good question. I got this from Senator Ranum, and I can't answer that question as we speak, but I certainly would be happy as this bill progresses to work on that and make sure we address it appropriately.
If I understand your question, Representative Ellison, would the answer be it's a condition of the release?
I don't know, Mr. Chair, I don't know, because the thing is if you go to a revocation hearing, and then somebody's going to have to argue, state the basis for the revocation in the hearing, and if it is that you failed a poly, is that going to be admissible under the current law with regard to the admissibility of polygraph results? Maybe Mr. Lippman has a thought.
Mr. Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think that the hearings and release units, they're obliged to provide due process, but I don't think it's the heightened standard with respect to admissibility that would be obliged at a court. That's certainly my understanding, and I'm not going to inquire further and get back to you.
Mr. Chair, are there any cases? I know there's cases with regard to a trial.
Not in this circuit.
All right.
Anything else?
Nope. All right. Not that I'm aware. I'm aware of this issue in the Ninth Circuit, and I'd be glad to cite a chapter and verse at another time.
If there are no further questions or discussion on the A-18 amendment that is now before us, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no.
Aye.
Motion prevails. 18 is adopted. Next amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final amendment, the A-17 amendment. This amendment simply requires that all level 3 offenders that are out have to go to the authority they are required to register with every 6 months to be photographed. We know that sex offenders change their appearance, have lots of different names. This just would help us know who they are and where they are.
Representative Zellers.
one very brief question, Mr. Chairman, before I yes
go ahead.
Would there be any local fiscal impact that we need to, either with DOC or a county sheriff or whoever the authority is? That's my only concern, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can look. I believe I had a fiscal note previously on it. If you give me just 1 minute, I'll look at mine previously.
If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can go into my hospital proposal that's up one floor for you. It takes up some time.
Representative Zellers, they can wait. And if they can't, just let us know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. There was not a local fiscal note requested previously on the bill.
Okay. Any discussion or further questions? On the A-17 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any further discussion? If not, on that amendment, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Is there anyone here? There is in our packet says an 0363 amendment. Anyone lay claim to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman. That's my amendment. Representative Abler asked me to present that in the committee.
What does it do? take a look at it and then tell us, committee.
Chairman, members, part of the provision of the bill would of 1406 is that if there is a disqualifying offense, there are certain ranges of criminal conduct that disqualify folks from working in healthcare settings, providing direct contact services. There is a process by which if someone has a criminal history which would ordinarily disqualify, that person can request, under certain circumstances, waivers of the relevant commissioner, either the Commissioner of Human Services or the Commissioner of Health, to work notwithstanding this disqualifying bar of criminal history. This language inserted into the bill would, pending that review, Commissioner Goodenough, Commissioner Mandinek, may I work in X daycare, X hospital, X nursing home, that they could work under the supervision of the provider. The governor's bill and representative bill as originally introduced would not allow folks to work in those settings until there had been the waiver granted. The current law allows people to, while they're requesting relief, work, and this would amend the bill so as to conform with current law. More closely conform with current law.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would allow for continuous direct supervision so that, if they wouldn't just be put back in unsupervised, they would have to be very closely watched so that, we're not having people removed that eventually would be put back in and be allowed to work back there again.
And the amendment is styled for the second engrossment. We're working off the third engrossment. Can our counsel direct us at the correction that should be made on this 363 amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment should refer to the third engrossment on line 1, so delete second and insert third. On line 3, the proper page and line references are page 91 and line 19. On line 5, the proper page and line references are page 91, line 23.
All right. Give us a moment. All right. That amendment is corrected then is before us. And Representative Zellers, you want this amendment? The chair will move the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion on the amendment? If not, those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House file 1406 as amended then is before us for a discussion at the time. I'd like to take 10 minutes for any discussion if we need it. Representatives Paymar, then Ellison.
Just one quick question. I did. Ms. Zoller is going to provide, I don't know if we're meeting after session or not.
Representative Paymar, we're going to have to.
Okay. Ms. Zoller is going to provide the research that I was speaking about. I think Mr. Lippman has it now, but I think the committee should look at it because this is a fairly significant a proposal here, and I do believe that we should look at the unintended consequences of what we may be doing, as well-meaning as it might be. I just have one question, Representative.
Representative Paymar, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we'll have that opportunity to do so because this bill will be held over for future action by this committee, so there'll be additional time to delve into that if you choose. Now go ahead, and I apologize for interrupting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Zellers. Just one question, just a quick question, because I want to know where you're coming from on this. I spent the last 25 years of my life working on behalf of crime victims, both in my professional life and my political life. So when there's a crime like the Bruce Eugene case and many others in the state and across the country, our hearts go out to their families, and we want to do what's right, and we want to toughen things up. But I just want to get your perspective on something, because you have all of these 8 criteria where someone could be a sex offender, if I understand the bill correctly, could be incarcerated for life without parole. Not first offense, not killing the victim. That's correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then there are other people who have murdered their victim, has killed somebody with premeditation, has killed someone in the course of committing felony crimes, has killed a human being while committing child abuse, has killed a human being while committing domestic abuse. These are all heinous crimes that were not just assaults, but they were actually taking of somebody's life. And yet these individuals can be released potentially after 30 years of incarceration. So I'm just trying to understand it. Apparently you're equating, as heinous as it might be, the 8 criteria here for under sexual offense, that you're equating that crime and the penalty as the same as taking somebody's life. Is that correct? I'm asking Mr. Zellers, Representative Zellers.
Representative Zellers.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Litter, Commissioner, Director Littman did ask to comment as well, but the very end of your statement was exactly that, could be released. Under indeterminate sentencing, I would hope that those folks are never released.
Mr. Chair, you're not.
Representative Paymar.
I don't think you're understanding my question. I'm talking about someone who commits a homicide as opposed to someone who rapes somebody on a first offense. Never has an opportunity to get released, but someone who kills somebody
and
does have the opportunity to get released.
Representative Zellers.
Chairman Smith, Representative Paymar, that is a separate discussion as well. We had that discussion last year. What about murder? What about rape? These are two separate, in my opinion, and I'll let Director Littman speak as well, these are two separate crimes. Murder and rape have, and we talked about this, the mentality or the thoughts of a psychopath. Personally, I think that in some of the cases with rape and with the molestation, mutilation, whatever it may be, I think that those crimes, especially for the victims who have to live with it for the rest of their life going forward, are worse crimes in some cases. Yes, giving your life is the ultimate. We can't break that back. But for those victims that are going to be out there suffering with what these predators have laid upon them, personally, I think that they do belong in prison for a very, very long time, and in some cases, yes, for the rest of their life.
We have Representative Ellison and Eastland. I'd like you to take just 1 minute if you're making discussion. Then we're going to lay the bill over, and then I'm going to go to Representative Knobloch before we conclude for the day. So, Representative Ellison, please be brief. Thank you.
I will be, Mr. Chair. You know, I could be brief because Representative Paymar already hit my point. You know, if you walk into a grocery store and you aim a gun at somebody and you discharge it into them, you know, you can get out, you know, after 30 years. If you kill somebody without planning it out, but you intend to kill them, you get first time offense, you're getting 306 months. You'll be out in about 17 years when you count the period of confinement, 17 and a half years. Yet rape, which is without any doubt heinous, horrible crime, sex offense, it just seems like there's a proportionality problem here. And I just wonder if somebody could address it.
Mr. Jones?
Mr. Whitman.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think it's the problem, what I call the tyranny of ordering, which is, I think in the governor's judgment, Representative Zeller's judgment, that we might, in a separate discussion, want to look at the question of the sentences for murders. But the question I think presented in this bill, even though it might be temporary to create some disproportionality, is the best and right practice. In the confines of this bill, we're trying to determine what is the appropriate sentences for these offenders and contributes to public safety. The fact that there may well be further impacts as far as the comparison of proportionality with other crimes, I think that's a discussion for other days. And it would not be right, the reverse would not be right, which is to postpone reform on sex crimes until you can address the right proportionality on murder first. I think it unnecessarily delays for what might be a rhetorical point, but I mean as far as the policy point, we're trying to find the very best sex offender practice, and we would urge members, notwithstanding perhaps correct arguments on proportionality, this is the best practice that we're aiming at, and that's we're trying to do the best line drawing that we can in the context of this bill.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is just going to a different issue, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. It's just an observation. But you know, we're going to a lot of lengths to I think really emphasize safety, getting the worst people locked up. But the reality is about, I don't know, 75-80% of people convicted of criminal sexual conduct are still going to be released someday. And I guess my concern is, if we're going to put them in prison longer, what are we going to do with them while they're there? And I see there's a little section in here, it's on page 36 of the bill, where it talks about the commissioner is going to provide for some sex offender programs. And then it talks about the plan may include co-payments from the offender and that sort of thing. But there still is nothing in here that really prescribes, is some of the time going to be used productively, or is it strictly up to the discretion of corrections to do that? And I think the policy in most cases in corrections now is they reserve treatment till the end. And it would seem like in some cases it would be good to get some of these people in treatment right away. And I guess, could you comment on that just briefly and maybe talk about how that's reflected in the fiscal note, if it is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, I think a couple of points, very briefly. I think that there is a consensus that that we need treatment and additional treatment resources. The governor's budget has additional monies this biennium for treatment within prison, additional treatment beds, and also additional resources for sex offender treatment in supervised release. The provision that you point to on page 36 wants to try and supersize the sex offender treatment by providing statutory authority for on an ability to pay that there might be some co-payments, much like we pay for Blue Cross and Blue Shield, that there might be a regime where offenders could contribute and thereby lengthening the or strengthening the amount of resources that are available. Also, I think your argument augurs for longer sentences because, frankly, sex offender treatment, if done right, is a lengthy process. If we're to have some assurances for the results, and it requires some time to take, and we think sentences in this bill for serious, oftentimes highly disordered people, this is the appropriate response. It's the resources and the time for treatment to work in prison.
Representative Sodas, from brief comment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have would like to know if there are a lot of juvenile sex offenders. We have not talked about that group of people at all. And I would think that if we really cared about what was going to happen in the future in this issue, that we would spend some money and some studies on what we can do to stop those people will be in our system in the future. And we all know that many, I don't know what the percent is, perhaps you know, of our sex offenders have been sexually abused themselves. They're people that have been abused in some way growing up. And so if, you know, hurting people hurt people, we are going to have a greater problem in the future if we don't do something about treatment and identifying them. And I understand teachers will say that they can tell you, even in grade school perhaps, those children that are going to be in our system. And I would just like to applaud Representative Murphy that is always concerned about the juvenile situation. And can you answer some of those questions? Thank you.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Soderstrom, the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy on page 42 of their report identifies as the what they call the next frontier of issues, which is giving increasing attention to juvenile offenders. The point that the Governor's Commission points to is that roughly 20% of the patients who are civilly committed have a long and fairly heinous criminal offense history as juveniles. So if you think about getting a young man of 18 to 25 with a long history of criminal sexual misconduct as a juvenile and then civilly commit them from age 19 or so to well into the future because of the nature of their crimes, that is a huge resource commitment and also a big commitment to, with respect to the lives that are spent segregated and insecure treatment on both ends of that question. And so I think it's something that people in the administrations are laser-like focused on to try and develop effective intervention strategies, because we know that the out years, 20 years out, this is going to be the problem. Today's juvenile offender who is highly disordered and who is involved in serial misconduct is going to be a problem for many, many years to come.
Very good. We'll have additional time in a bit down the road for further discussion. The chair lays this bill over. Thank you for appearing. And we're going to take another bill before we
thank you, Mr. Chairman, member recess.
Thank you very much. We'll take one last bill before we recess. House File 1926, Representative Knobloch. Burglary crimes demanded. All right, this bill will be moved by the chair, and then when we're done with our discussion, it will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The chair moves House File 1926. Furthermore, there is currently being passed out an amendment, H1926DE1, to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. The chair also moves the DE1 amendment. You will discuss that, but first I'd like to give you the courtesy of having this bill amended accordingly on that motion. If there's no discussion, the DE1 amendments, those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, then House File 1926, as amended, is before us. Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for accommodating me, especially in light of the very important bill that you just spent some time talking about. I appreciate it, especially because I've got with me Mark Arnold, who's the deputy chief of the City of Wake Park in my district, who has driven down here today, and I'm glad we could accommodate him. He brought this bill to me concerned with experiences he's had that he feels, and I feel, require a change in the burglary statute, in particular with regard to intent and the problems that the police sometimes experience when they come upon someone in a building who actually hasn't stolen anything but is in the building, obviously looking like they are intending to do something, but how can they prove intent? This would basically clarify the statute to make it clearer that when a person forces entry into a building, that the police have a better case against them. And with that brief introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Arnold to talk about his experiences and need for the bill.
Officer Arnold, welcome. Give us your name for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Mark Arnold. I am Deputy Chief of the City of Wake Park. The reason that I'm here this morning is, and I'd ask Mr. Knobloch to proceed with this bill, is that we experienced most recently in the last 2 months a career burglar entering a school within my city. Forced entry was done by the subject, and we apprehended him in the building because of the alarm activating. After the investigation was complete, the way the statute currently reads now, because the police could not, or we could not, prove the intent of this person to commit another crime in that building, we basically had a damage to property because he broke a window with a value of a misdemeanor level, and trespassing, which is a misdemeanor. So the county attorney denied burglary charges on that event. What I did do is we went back and through some thorough investigation and interviewing of the suspect got him to subsequently admit, after finding a forced key box in the building opened, that he did that, which now give us that level to charge the burglary. I guess the bottom of it is that if you or any of you in a home, if I break into your home, as the current statute reads, I can go through your personal belongings. If I don't damage anything else, I can sit down on the couch and wait for the police to come and arrest me, and there's no burglary intent here at all. We're talking about a forced entry into a locked residence or a business that we cannot charge these people with a felony-level crime. The other part that kind of put this in a catch-22 is that law enforcement uses a number of tools to apprehend these people in the commission of this crime. One of them is that the police canine is usually deployed after warnings are given to apprehend these people. In all the departments pretty much in the state of Minnesota, and me being experienced as a canine trainer and handler for over 17 years, the policy is to deploy the canine on felony situations only. And if we're using our tools to apprehend a felon and we're determining that we have to make a determination if we have a felony or not on a forced entry, I think it hampers law enforcement's ability to use their tools and do their job effectively. So in brief, that's why I'm here. It's been a glitch in the system for some time. This is not the first time I've seen this happen. The change in the law that Mr. Knobloch has handed to me that I read over this morning, I think covers what we're looking to accomplish and making sure these people pay for the crime they do. So I'd like to thank you for your time and appreciate you having me here.
Chief Arnold, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions of this witness, Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Chief Knobloch, I'm sorry, Chief, I didn't catch your name. I'm sorry.
Mark Arnold, just Mark, this way.
Mark, thank you for your testimony. If you hadn't found evidence that that suspect tried to pry open the lockbox, then you wouldn't have the crime that would be required under here, and you still would be stuck with that damage to property and trespass. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So does this bill really get you where you're trying to go if you don't find the evidence of the crime inside the dwelling?
Yes, because of the addition of the wording that enters a building without consent through the use of force accomplishes that. That line item is as added there. If you look under on first, yeah, second, and third degree.
I'm seeing that.
Okay.
But we still got to prove a crime was committed inside the dwelling once you get in there. Isn't that right? And commits a crime while in the building. Isn't that there?
Well, it says,
Representative Knobloch, I think the answer is no, but would you take a look at the bill and answer that question if you can? I think the answer is no, Representative Ellison.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I think that there's a... First, I guess you got to look at, are you talking first, second, or third degree? But I guess beyond that, you've got some other qualifiers. For example, underneath first degree, if we're talking about a home, a bank, etc. I mean, I think there's some other qualifiers involved.
I guess I was looking at Representative Ellison. If there's no crime committed, entering the building without consent or through the use of force, doesn't that answer your question as a no? I don't know.
I think there's a no, yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? Discussion? Deputy Chief, thank you for coming today. Glad we could get your bill. Representative Knobloch, the bill has been moved. It's before us. The chair lays the bill over on the table at this time.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you again for accommodating me and Chief Arnold. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
hey Mary, what is that?
Well, members, in a minute we're going to go into recess, and we're going to recess until after session, which begins at 3. So I think we will recess until 45 minutes after session or the call of the chair. whichever I decide. The other uncertainty is that actually it's a certainty is we've got room 300 north. This frankly is not an optimum place, so I hope that we can focus on our bills except for one. They're intended for the intended and headed for the table. So be concise when we get there, and we'll try to start shortly after session. We all know that it will be a brief session as well. So with that, no questions. This committee stands in recess.